This is Tax Update for Saturday, December 17th, 2005. Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those who are not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of this document. Such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a continuing education presentation for which a fee is charged. This week we add something new. This podcast is being sponsored by Limeburg Services, an organization that provides email newsletters on tax-related topics for a monthly subscription, as well as access to their library of prior newsletters, edited versions of threads from online discussion groups, archives of these podcasts now, and other information of use to tax professionals. You can get more information by visiting Limeburg Services at limeburgservices.com. This week, we take a look at the IRS's most recent release on penalties for substantial understatement and the adequate disclosure provisions that allow an exception to those penalties. The IRS has issued Revenue Procedure 2005-75. That revenue procedure updates Revenue Procedure 2004-73. In fact, this revenue procedure is updated each year to tell us what will constitute adequate disclosure for purposes of the penalties under Section 6662D and the preparer penalty under 6694A. What we want to talk about today is the nature of the substantial underpayment penalty, as well as what constitutes adequate disclosure as we head into tax return preparation season. The substantial underpayment penalty is found in Internal Revenue Code Section 6662a, which provides the penalty as noted. If this section applies to any portion of underpayment of tax required to be shown in a return, there shall be added to the tax an amount equal to 20% of the portion of the underpayment to which this section applies. Essentially, there is a 20% extra penalty added on top of the tax due if you fall under the substantial understatement provisions of Code Section 6662. In 6662B, we enumerate, essentially, the five basic areas, the five basic types of understatements that are going to be considered subject to the substantial penalties. This section shall apply the portion of any underpayment which is attributable to one or more of the following, and it notes these five: negligence or disregard of the rules or regulations, any substantial understatement of income tax, number 2, any substantial valuation misstatement under Chapter 1, any substantial overstatement of pension liabilities, and any substantial estate or gift tax valuation understatement. Now, note, we're going to deal here with the substantial understatement of income tax provision here, a definition that is found in Section 6662D. And that provides at D1 what's basically a mechanical test for what is a substantial understatement of tax. 6662D1A provides that there's a substantial understatement of income tax for any taxable year if the amount of the understatement for the tax year exceeds 10% of the amount of tax required to be shown on the return, or $5,000, and basically exceeds the greater of those two. So, essentially, this provision will provide for an understatement of 10% or $5,000, whichever is greater, compared to the amount required to be shown on the return. Now, there is a special rule for corporations other than S corporation, basically, or a personal holding company. There, the number is 10% of the tax return on the return for the year, or if greater, $10,000, or $10 million. Isn't that nice? They're basically, so there's a cap here, meaning that you have $10 million is automatic, even if that is less than 10% of the tax required to be shown on the return. Basically, yeah, so you always would get there at $10 million. So there was a cap put in there. At 6662D2, we find the understatement is the difference between the amount of tax required to be shown in the return of the taxable year versus the amount imposed, which is shown in the return reduced by any rebate. And the excess shall be determined without regard to items to which Section 6662 Cap A applies. Essentially, we have a mechanical definition here of what's a substantial understatement. You compute the number, you compare that to the amount that the IRS is going to be assessing on this as the proper amount of tax, and if you're over that limit, the 20% penalty would apply. However, Congress didn't intend this to be solely mechanical. The point of this was not to provide a situation where every time you were understated by this amount, automatically a 20% penalty applied. Congress realized that the tax law gets complicated. We may have a $5,000 assessment or an assessment in excess of 10% of the amount of tax due, and it may be due to a reasonable difference of opinion on how the tax law should apply, and that itself should not be tainted. What Congress provided was, in the case of items not a tax shelter, as defined by these rules, that there would be a waiver of this penalty to the extent that the provisions or the position was adequately disclosed on the return. That is found essentially at Section 6662D2B. And that says the amount of the understatement shall be reduced, which is by the amount which is attributable to the tax treatment for which, if there is or was substantial authority for such treatment, or any item, if the relevant facts affecting the item's tax treatment are adequately disclosed in a return or in a statement attached to the return, and there is a reasonable basis. Now, we have substantial authority, we're fine. If we don't have substantial authority, then if we have a reasonable basis and we've disclosed, we can get out of this penalty. Now, it says, for purposes of Clause 2, double cap I, no event shall a corporation be treated as having a reasonable basis for its tax treatment of item attributable to a multiple-party financing transaction if such treatment does not clearly reflect the income of the corporation. So they wrote an exception. Down in D2C, they also wrote an exception that indicates the reduction does not apply to tax shelters. So no matter if we have substantial authority or a reasonable basis, shall not apply to any item related to a tax shelter. And at 6662D2C, it tells us that a tax shelter means a partnership or other entity, any investment plan or arrangement, or any other plan or arrangement if a significant purpose of such partnership, entity, plan, or arrangement is the avoidance or evasion of federal income tax. Now we have a little aside here. For those of you who've looked at the Circular 230 regulations that came out this summer, which are applicable to us, you may find that a reliance opinion seems to fall into this category, that this is almost word for word the definition of what would constitute a reliance opinion when a preparer gives a better than 50% chance of prevailing on such a matter. Now, this raises an interesting question. Since, as you should be aware, the disclaimer that people are placing on all kinds of documentation these days basically is only valid for getting you out of a reliance opinion from having to issue a covered opinion, it raises an interesting issue. This is virtually the same definition as would apply to the reliance opinion. The query, would an agent reading the disclaimer on a document that described a position that was taken on the tax return decide that since the CPA had issued a disclaimer that would only be valid against a reliance opinion, and since a reliance opinion would only exist if, in fact, it met the same definition that we find here for the tax shelter, will the agent attempt to argue that the CPA implicitly suggested that this transaction was a tax shelter, and that, therefore, the substantial underpayment penalty automatically should apply because it doesn't apply to tax shelters, and the CPA's disclaimer would seem to indicate the CPA had some reason to believe this was a tax shelter. Again, not suggesting that's the correct position because I don't believe it is, but it does suggest there are risks to this Circular 230 area that just keep coming out of the woodwork. It is no doubt not a coincidence that the IRS borrowed the language for a reliance opinion from this code section. it suggests that we may have an issue with the way we are interpreting Circular 230 versus the way we have for years interpreted Section 6662, because most of us have not taken the position that our clients were involved in a tax shelter. In any event, an interesting problem. And clearly, to the extent that a taxpayer is involved in a tax shelter, and we have gone into great detail of discussing how you could decide that almost anything might meet the standard that we list here, the taxpayer could not get out of this penalty. That said, the IRS has not seemed to take a broad position in throwing out this penalty on the theory that certain things that many of us are putting disclaimers on are tax shelters per se. So, as we note, but assuming we don't have a tax shelter, we do still have to worry about what is adequate disclosure. Well, adequate disclosure is defined each year by a revenue procedure. And this year, the revenue procedure in question is 2005-75. Now, the procedure is updated annually to basically give us what constitutes adequate disclosure. And what we want to take a look at here is the definitions involved here. Now, the IRS did point out there were a few mechanical changes made in 2004-73. So if you want to take a look at that, in the beginning of the ruling, they tell us that they've clarified that the disregard provisions and not the negligence provisions of the 6662 accuracy penalty are subject to an adequate disclosure exception. So they want to make clear that this is not carte blanche. They also indicate they modified for the amendment of 6662D1B, which revised this threshold for understatements for corporations. They updated it for the tax law changes effective after December 31st, 2005. They divided section 4.01, so in case you remember the old ruling by that much detail, you now can understand it's divided in two. Most of us probably didn't remember it in that detail. A new paragraph was added to reemphasize, which is true under the code, that if a related party transaction is involved, you do not get the adequate disclosure protection. Another example has been added for disclosing an item on a line that does not have a preprinted description. Remarked, a new paragraph has been added cautioning the entry of amount on a line will not provide adequate disclosure if the item is attributable to a tax shelter or does not have a reasonable basis and supporting records. And also reference the enactment of Code 170F12 about the charitable contribution of a qualified vehicle, boat, or airplane having a value of more than $500 for purposes of these rules. So if you happen to have 2004-73 memorized, that's the modifications you need to make under this one. Presuming you didn't have that memorized in detail, perhaps you would like to go back and take a look at what's actually in here. Interestingly enough, Section 4 of the procedures, we get the guidance on what's adequate disclosure. The first section of Section 4 tells us the basic background in paragraph 0.01 of the things we have to do in general before getting into the specific details for specific types of transactions. We start out at 4.01, paragraph 1, tells us, in essence, the first key rule. You must fill out the forms properly and in line with their instructions. In general, it provides that, essentially, the forms must be completed in a clear manner and in accordance with their instructions. If you fail to do that, you'll note by reference under this provision, it would appear you could not have adequate disclosure. That can pose some interesting problems. Let's talk about one in specific that has dogged us for a long time in the e-filing arena, and that is the problem of Schedule D. Many of us have clients that have large numbers of Schedule D transactions. Clients that can go on for hundreds of specific transactions related to securities in a single tax year. In many cases, these clients provide the CPA with a stack of printouts from their broker that purport to break down the short and long-term gains and that purport to give us a proper reporting figure for that for the tax return. However, the instructions to Schedule D indicate, essentially, that we should enter the detail. And if we have too much detail to fit on one Schedule D, and with hundreds of transactions, you certainly are going to go past a single Schedule D, that we should fill those in on Schedule D1. Now, note that technically, attaching the paper to a paper return fails to qualify. That is, you didn't fill it in on Schedule D1 as the instructions seem to suggest, and by not doing so, it appears you may not have completed this in line with the way the instructions hold. However, it does seem very likely that a court would hold there was substantial compliance if, in fact, the form that was attached from the brokerage firm was reasonably coherent, that you could follow it, and that it basically was laid out in the same format as the Schedule D1, so that an IRS agent who was examining this return could essentially still find all the information about the specific sales and basis and all of that other good stuff that goes into the computation of Schedule D and the gain or loss on a sale of capital asset. However, for electronic filing, we have a bit more of a problem. For the e-file system used for individual returns, which is not the new modernized version that we have for corporations, there is no provision for attaching scanned documents to the return. Nor is there really any provision for making paper attachments except in limited circumstances, and Schedule D is not one of those that we are allowed to send a paper attachment in with the return. Therefore, here we face the same problem. But this time our issue is going to be that what the IRS has in its hand, if we just input the totals, will only be the totals. Now, many CPAs solve this problem, or claim to solve this problem, by noting that the details shall be available upon request or something similar attached to the return, and put that on as their description for the electronic filing. The problem is the IRS has never officially blessed this method. Unofficially, they've blessed it a number of times. E-filing representatives have suggested that seems fine. But we note that the IRS has never officially blessed it, never put out on paper that this is an acceptable method. Per this revenue ruling, it would appear that the official guidance suggests it doesn't work, and that a taxpayer who does this, and for which there is an assessment based on a basis problem on Schedule D, could very well face a substantial underpayment penalty. Not that this is easily solved, nor will most CPAs who e-file and make a one-line item have ever any problem with this ever, but it does pose some very real issues that you need to understand. And paper filers need to be aware that they shouldn't take too much comfort in the fact that their paper went in with the return, because, as noted, the instructions seem to suggest you must line item enter. Now, we're all aware that most clients probably aren't going to pay for such entries, but if there is a substantial penalty and if the IRS were to succeed in assessing it, preparers need to be aware that a taxpayer may suddenly decide he or she would have paid for line item entry. Just another piece of good, clean fun that we get to play with during tax season. Next in line on the general requirements is the amounts involved must be verifiable. You cannot get an adequate disclosure exception if the amounts on the return are not amounts that can be verified. The taxpayer must be able to provide verification for items shown on the return. Now, it's not clear in detail what that means. Basically, the taxpayer needs to demonstrate the origin of the number, and the taxpayer can show good faith in entering that number on the form. Those are the two tests. It would appear that a Cohen number should meet this test. That is a number that under the Cohen case, where we are estimating and we can reasonably be allowed to do that, meaning it's not covered by something like 274D, should meet this verifiable issue if we were in good faith putting the number down. But if we don't have any reasonable basis under the Cohen standard, then we probably are going to have problems with a substantial understatement if the IRS decides to force the matter. Number three, cannot have a related party transaction. The ruling goes on to note the protection of disclosure under this ruling does not apply to related party. The IRS specifically says if an entry may present a legal issue or controversy because of related party transaction, then the transaction and the relationship must be disclosed on a Form 8275 disclosure statement or 8275R regulation disclosure statement. Now, that's an interesting issue, an interesting aside, and we know that many CPAs get concerned about the 8275 or 75R, or the client gets concerned believing it's a red flag. Nevertheless, if it's a related party transaction and there may be a problem, you may need an 8275 for your adequate disclosure. Number four, there must be a clear description if no line item description is present. If you're entering an expense on the other expense line of Schedule C, you must provide a clear identification of the item on that line or on a continuation attachment if the space is not adequate on the form. Finally, the IRS reminds us certain items have no protection. As the IRS notes, no matter what your disclosure, tax shelters are not protected. If the item does not have a reasonable basis as defined in Regulation 1.6662-3B3, or if the taxpayer has failed to keep adequate books and records with respect to the item or position. Interesting to note, failed to keep. Now back to the Cohen problem. If the Cohen problem exists because the taxpayer has failed to keep the records, but we've been allowed a Cohen a number, we may still have a problem because this ruling will not get us off the hook on that one if taken literally. After considering the general item, the ruling goes on to discuss specific items of disclosure. We're going to run through these rather quickly here. First section talks about Schedule A itemized deductions. Talks about medical and dental and says complete lines 1 through 4 supplying all required information. If you think about it, that's almost redundant from the theory that we had to fully fill in the form per the instructions, but nevertheless, they repeat that here. Taxes, again, we repeat, supply complete lines 5 through 9 supplying all required information. Nothing new, we already had to do that in the general standard. However, it does note that on line 8, the other taxes, we must list each type of tax and the amount paid. You can't lump them together. Each type must be specifically lined out. For interest expense, again, complete the line supplying all required information. But this protection does not apply to amounts disallowed under the investment interest rules if you didn't supply the investment interest deduction or an amount disallowed under Section 265. So if those are the positions of disallowance, you're not going to get protection under the adequate disclosure rules by doing this protection. Now, for contributions, we go into more detail dealing with the required substantiation rules. And these tell us the various things that we must have no matter what we have done. It also notes entering the value of a contribution that is not reduced by the value of the benefit received will not constitute adequate disclosure. So you're going to have to do more than just basically list numbers. You're going to have to also get those offsets for any items received, and finally, you must have the acknowledgments under 170F8 or 170F12. Casualty or theft losses. If you have those, you must attach Form 4684, and each item or article for which a casualty or theft loss is claimed must be listed on the 4684. That finishes the itemized deductions. For trade or business expenses, casualty and theft losses, we essentially repeat what we just did for itemized deductions. For legal expenses, the amounts claimed must be stated, so you can't lump legal in with other items. Be careful, sometimes I've seen clients want to lump legal and accounting, and some accounting programs like to lump legal and accounting together. Be forewarned, you probably want to break the legal out. Also, though the IRS indicates the section does not apply to items properly characterized as capital expenditures, Personal expenditures are non-deductible lobbying or political expenditures, including amounts that are required to be or that are amortized over a period of years. Well, interestingly enough, that appears to be all the standard challenges to legal expenses. As we discussed last week in the issue of legal expenses in the tax return, the problem we have is quite often the question is it a capitalized item or is it a personal item? Well, you get no protection from that if that's the reason why the legal expenses are disallowed on Schedule C. For bad debt, the amount written off must be stated. Item D, reasonableness of officer's compensation. Schedule E on Form 1120 must be completed when required. Now, a key issue here is the dime devoted to the business must be expressed as a percentage, as opposed to part or as needed. That is an issue because sometimes accountants have used that method. What the IRS is saying, if a percentage does not go in those boxes, you have not adequately disclosed for the compensation question, and if in fact reasonable compensation becomes an issue, the IRS may be able to now assert the penalty due to lack of adequate disclosure. It also notes that the section does not apply to golden parachute payments under 280 cap G, or it will not apply to the extent the remuneration paid or incurred exceeds the 1 million employee remuneration limitation if applicable in this case. For repair expenses, the amounts claimed must be stated. This section does not apply, again almost humorously, to any repair expenses properly characterized as capital expenditures or personal expenditures. In most cases, that's the whole question of repair expenses. But nevertheless, you do not get protection of this revenue procedure if that's your issue. Finally, for taxes other than foreign taxes, the amount claimed must be stated. Differences in book and income tax reporting, you must fill in Schedule M1 and Schedule M3 as required. The information provided reasonably must be expected to apprise the service of the nature of any potential controversy arising from tax treatment of item. If the information provided does not so apprise the service, then again you're instructed to file an 8275 or 8275R. And it says see Part 2 of the instructions for those forms in that case. It notes that an item reported on a pre-printed description shown in attached schedule or itemized on the M1 may represent the aggregate of several transactions producing the items. In some cases, it notes, the potentially controversial item may involve a portion of the amount disclosed in the schedule. The IRS will not be deemed to be reasonably apprised of the controversy by the amount disclosed. In these instances, you must use the 8275. Reminder again. The combining of unlike items on Schedule M1 or M3 or a statement attached to them will not constitute adequate disclosure. You can't lump all your adjustments together. There are a number of issues for foreign tax items, including international boycotts must be disclosed on transactions disclosed on 5713, must be completed in 5713. Schedule A, Schedule B, and Schedule C must be completed when required by the instructions. And transactions under Section 6114 or 7701B is disclosed on Form 8833. So put those in the right position. For moving expenses, you must attach the Form 3903. This is on the other miscellaneous. For employee business expenses, you've got to complete the 2106 or 2106EZ and attach to the return. But this protection does not apply to club dues or to travel expenses for any non-employee accompanying the taxpayer on the trip. That is, taking the spouse along. For the fuels credit, Form 4136 must be filled in and attached to the return. And for investment credit, you must complete Form 3468. This particular revenue procedure will apply to any return filed on a 2005 tax form for a taxable year beginning in 2005, and to any tax return filed on a 2005 tax form in 2006 for a short taxable year beginning in 2006. So basically, for the returns that have 2005 on the top of them that you're using for the 2005 forms, these are the rules for getting showing that you have adequately disclosed the position. These rules are useful to review and consider heading into tax season so that in case an issue does arise, you'll be able to defend the fact that a position was adequately disclosed. Remember, the $5,000 or 10% trigger comes in play and technically makes the imposition of the penalty automatic if you aren't able to bring in the reasonable basis, or you aren't able to bring in your position to show that in fact the position was one for which in essence you had the proper position, you had substantial authority. So if you don't meet the substantial authority test, you must meet the reasonable basis test. And the reasonable basis test is the one that's going to require disclosure to go along with that reasonable basis. Let us remember, a reasonable basis doesn't mean we have a greater than 50% chance of prevailing. What it does mean is that we're going to have a reasonable basis of prevailing, or at least some chance of it. And if that's the case, then adequate disclosure becomes an issue. You should consider adequate disclosure for significant positions where it is conceivable the IRS might decide that the authority that you have would not constitute substantial authority, but rather might meet the reasonable basis test. Now, this has been Tax Update for Saturday, December 17, 2005. Again, Tax Update is not intended for those who are not skilled in tax research and able to do their own research. And again, beginning this week, Tax Update is brought to you by Limeburg Services. You can visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. This has been Tax Update for Saturday, December 17th, 2005.